Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little later on today's program, we'll be talking about some of the music and memories of the Muni Opera over the years. But we will begin with discussion of some more recent memories, Ferguson, its ferment, and its fallout. Our guest is Reverend F. Willis Johnson, the senior minister at Wellspring Church in Ferguson, and the author of Holding Up Your Corner, Talking About Race in Your Community. In a sense, it's a guidebook for men and women of the cloth on how to deal with racial and social injustice from a faith-based perspective. So nice to have you back with us again.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk a little about that book, and I think we better start with the title and explain what that means.
Well, there's a kind of biblical narrative about some folks who had amongst them a hurt colleague, friend, and they organize themselves, coordinate together to take their friend who was hurting to the source of help and hope. And believe it or not, during one of the town hall, earliest town hall meetings with National Public Radio, Michelle Martin and your good folks, she asked me to help close out that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I, drawing on that familiar story shared about at the time, that our best response was to understand our community, our situation as one that was a hurt, a great hurt, a trauma, and that the best that we could do at this point would organize ourselves around taking a piece of the mat, grabbing a corner, and working together to get whatever hurt and hurt ones to a place and to a point where they could be helped and hoped. And that kind of resonated across the continuum of not only August of 2014, but it became very significant as it related to how both in my ministry, both my family and I worked through, lived through, witnessed through the months and now years since. And so we try to help people figure out what they can do because Ferguson was not the only place.
Sure. Well, what is the hurt quotient in Ferguson right now?
Well, I'm sure as you talk to folks and you spend time in the community, it will vary. To say that hurt does not remain, that we are still not injured from the events of August 2014 would be dishonest. I personally, and I know a lot of folks may be upset by what I'm about to say, the divide has deepened. Maybe in some cases we've gotten further entrenched. And the pain, the trauma for some is much as great as it was then. But overall as a community, I think we are still trying to find what we can do to not relapse into the places where we were deepest scarred.
You know, I think it's going to be a disappointment to a lot of people to hear you say that because so much attention has been paid to Ferguson over these last couple of years, and a lot of people have tried to help. I mean, they've looked for help from the legislature, they've looked for help from the Justice Department, they've looked for it from a lot of sources, and yet you say the pain is still fairly intense.
Yes, I think whenever you center your focus on mere personality or personnel, whenever you are dependent on programmatic or these ideas of recreating place, that's not where this emanated and where this is experienced and dealt with at the deepest level. You're talking about the fact that people are hurting in ways and in places and that are much internal. And so while we have, in both my ministry work and also in the larger community work, have dedicated ourselves to trying to do those things that model, promote, or there's been resources in terms of individuals and otherwise coming in, trying to do programming and provide certain kinds of tangible things, what we really were dealing with was the living out of the violence that has been both historical and systematic in not only this community, but in much of humanity. We have terribly been violent and dehumanizing, disingenuous, and hurtful to one another, unfortunately, since the biblical record. And we've never addressed that. And programs and legislation and justice reports don't force people to acknowledge, to love, and to act with a greater interest for other than self. And that's what continues to plague not only Ferguson, in communities like it.
It seems to be particularly intense right now. You talk about going back to biblical times, and there have been very dramatic periods, but we're going through a period in this country right now of polarization, and there's an awful lot of hate out there, it seems to me. And that doesn't help a situation that's trying to heal.
No, not at all. Yeah. Unfortunately, Brother Marsh, what we see is that we have feelings that are literally and figuratively trumping fact. Mm-hmm. Our feelings, our emotions, and so there's even a greater heightened sense of fear among people towards the other. There's a greater sense, and we've talked about this offline a little bit, there's even a greater sense of towards self-preservation, whether that means in the individual space or in what we're seeing more largely in kind of this ethnic and socio-cultural kind of dynamic as well.
It's kind of enabling, it seems to me, this atmosphere that we're just talking about here and mm-hmm. just describing. The people who might have been inclined to move in one direction now feel that they can, and it's okay to dislike, hate, criticize, and condemn rather than condone the mm-hmm. other.
Yeah. Not only is it an act of convenience and a failed and veiled sense of creating false comfort, it's always been the nature of kind of the capitalistic or reality of this of our society. It is big business. It has always been big business to keep people oppressed, subjugated. And we've always had to, because of the historical precedent, and we talk about this in the book, there's a historical precedence of dehumanizing, being violent, and disrespecting the sacredness of others. And so in order to justify in a system like business or capitalism or economies, we have to rationalize why that is okay. Mm-hmm. And so we now have a political machine and infrastructure that is normalizing through culture, learned behavior, popular spaces, and so forth, who are making it normal, acceptable, assumed behavior. And what we have tried to do in our work and in our witness, personally and otherwise, and in this book, is to help people not really solve that problem in and of itself. This is not a how-to and a recipe, but it is much like the biblical narrative, it is an opportunity to look into the mirror. This is about self-assessment. And that's principally the one thing, honestly, in Ferguson and in places like Ferguson and across this community, people are not taking the time to assess themselves.
What is the role of the church in all of this?
Well, interestingly, the role of the church is and that's, this will vary from individuals. I mean, you know, we obviously have these ideas around and practices around separation of church and state. I tell people all the time, you can't legislate love. But the church, faith communities, and people who find themselves rooted in some type of tradition of belief that, as much of the major religions of the world suggest, that find themselves, one, in community. The basic tenets of most faith traditions invite people into community and responsibility for not only themselves but others. Mm-hmm. And institutions like the church are encouraged to not only endorse that, but to embody it and to help people to evidence that or exhibit that. Secondly, we provide, and particularly in the African-American tradition historically, it has been an institution or a resource that actually fuels the innovation, the revolution, the change. We cannot expect our oppressor to fund our liberation. And that's obviously a borrowed expression. But this idea that any of the social and political and truly economic and empowering movements that have made what, particularly in Western, in the United States, Western culture significant and longstanding, have come out of faith-rootedness and institutions of faith traditions. So our social service models, our hospitals, our philanthropic legacies have their seeding in these kinds of institutions. And so we need to hearken back as best as we can into those practices and philosophies.
Do you sense any kind of a movement of this type now?
There is, and there's always been. What is a struggle for most practitioners or professionals like myself, and we experienced this in the moment, you have an ancient kind of narrative and text that you're trying to make life and sense out of in now. And so most folks, most practitioners don't have language that translates well then with now. And then you match that with the leanings of the world. You know, what is necessary to be successful or to navigate these times as being expressed politically and otherwise puts you in jeopardy possibly with most faith traditions. And so we hear things like the moral mandates. We hear things about the inalienable rightness that is being dishonored or disrespected in the common practices like healthcare in this nation, or are we so disrespectful of creation that we assume that we have no footprint, no imprint on what is causing the failure and the erosion of the creation, so much so that now we legislate to say it's all right for us to kill creation and in turn kill ourselves. Mm-hmm. That kind of misalignment or incongruence, the church or institutions and faith rootedness are invited to at least bring into question and invite people to make assessment, discern, decision, and determination around what is not only right, but what's righteous.
Was I correct in describing your book as kind of a guideline for people of the cloth, if you will, to deal with these issues?
Obviously, I'm a pastor. I'm a cleric, and people know me or associate my presence, particularly in Ferguson and in our relationship with both the institution and the nature of the church. And so, yes, this is written for people who do what I do, or you know, kind of every day. But let's understand this: being a practitioner of our faith is not reserved to the imam, mm-hmm. or to the rabbi, or to the pastor. All of us are called, whether we are Muslim or Jewish or Jew or Judeo-Christian or Protestant, and even in our other faiths of Hindu and so forth, we're all called into acts of responsibility and in community. And so what we are trying to do is give a practical resource and tool to those kinds of professional persons. But it really spans for the educator. It spans for the coach. Because all of us have to deal with some of the stuff that is, one, we need to acknowledge there's some stuff that's not right in the world. Mm-hmm. And we need to be active. We need to activate our sense of affirmation or sacredness and dignity of others. And we all have a role to play. It's not our fault, but it is our fight.
You do say, though, that the people of the church, your colleagues, your compatriots, your associates, are uniquely qualified to spot injustice?
Well, if not just uniquely qualified, I will say they are expected, required. They are both invited and implored to do so, because if we are not willing and wanting to wrestle, I say it all the time wherever I go to speak, and it's the most powerful nugget I got from my graduate level experience of seminary. Rabbi Joshua Heschel, the lone kind of rabbi that is known in the civil rights movement to have walked across the William Pettus Bridge with Dr. Martin Luther King, he said this about our worship. We worship God with our questions. Too many of us present faith as an absolute, and as the answer, the penicillin, the antidote, where in actuality, whether you are Muslim, Jew, or Protestant, Catholic, you are invited to explore experience and be in question. God is big enough to deal with the nature of our uncertainty and our unassuredness. And that is where faith is sharpened, shaped, magnified, and we have a responsibility to be not only approached in question, but as a prophetic office, we raise question and critique, but we have to remain answerable to that same prophetic question and critique.
I want to pick up on that point after we take a break. My guest is Reverend Willis Johnson of the Wellspring Church in Ferguson, also the author of Holding Up Your Corner. We'll be back to continue our conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you prefer a tweet, try us at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Willis Johnson. Reverend, I have a note here that taken from your book that it just popped into my head, and I guess it's the age-old question, and maybe there is no answer, but if there is one, I think you have it. How do you convince people that God is concerned about all of humanity, all of us, when there is so much hurt and pain in the world and so much desperation?
I don't. Strangely enough, I don't think you can adequately convince the foolishness of preaching the power that resides, at least in my understanding and practice of the faith experience, and is that there is something beyond self and even beyond what I do and say to someone that does the convicting or the convincing. Our faith is, and at least in my practice and as a Protestant, we work on some basic assumptions for some or assurances by definition for others. Meaning that if I am the imago Dei or the image or the likeness of my Creator or God, and that my God, through the embodiment of, in our tradition, Jesus Christ, and that comes to life out of the word and witness, that brings us all to be one, and we're all in that oneness of likeness and also in oneness in community and family, then I work off of that assurance or that assumption, and it is so. Mm-hmm. And I'm confirmed, and it becomes affectionate to me when I actually see it. So I experience it as I do with you. You welcome and you greet me. You're concerned with me. And so when we get into this practice, again, of trying to find a personality or create a personality around faith, when we assume that only a certain place, like the church building, like Wellspring, you're not in church until you actually walk into this building. If you only have these programs that say when we act this way or do these things, that then we're being official, that we've learned is not convicting or convincing. There is something that is experienced, but it's based on this, for some, either an assumption or assurance given out of our tradition, that is not only possible, but it's promised. So I take a little bit different, unique approach to that.
It's a difficult sales job for those people who are the most unfortunate amongst us.
Yeah. I mean, let's just be honest. I pastor in Ferguson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. People know enough about Ferguson to know about both its economy, its way of life, and some of its challenges. And here I am as a pastor, just last night, for instance, to go into a mayoral forum that our Center for Social Empowerment, along with you good folks, helped to sponsor. As much as we talked about and people speak about some change, as a citizen in Ferguson, one who lives there, one who is active, we have to acknowledge that while there are some things that have changed, what may have not changed for real, and in large measure, are not hearts. What has not changed is the system. I don't care who you put on the council. The system is the system. I don't care who you put in a uniform and what you put on them in terms of technology. if the behavior and the philosophy and the heart of both the matter, the situation, or the effort and the institution have not been addressed, that's the problem. And all faith rootedness, all faith practice is about transformation, revolution, total systemic change or total overhaul, recalibration of the heart.
If you were to reduce the essence of your book, Holding Up Your Corner, to a sentence or a paragraph, what would it be, and would it apply as much to people and communities like who serve in communities like yours as it would to a white pastor in rural Missouri or a rural part of the country?
Yeah, actually, it's an acronym. Yeah. It's all a double iteration of A's. Acknowledge, affirm, act. Acknowledge is simply noticing, becoming aware of the fact that there are things in your community, in this world, that are not right nor righteous. Mm-hmm. To affirm is to understand that even when I don't when I do not understand or agree, that I give right and space for people to name and claim their own experience and situation. That even when I do not agree, to not agree or understand is not an act of both condemnation nor complicit. That we have that inalienable rightness, that sacredness of person and humanity, that gift from God to be able to name and claim our situation. And then lastly, to act. That all of us have a role or responsibility to address what is not right and where people are not being effectually acknowledged or received, that we are to be a model, and to borrow from Mahatma Gandhi, we must become the change that we wish to see. And so whether you are protesting, whether you're running for public office, whether you're praying and practicing in your various faith experiences, or just simply doing your best as a parent or educator or as a citizen or as a common man or woman walking out of Starbucks to hold the door and not flip somebody off while you're going down 170 because you didn't merge over from the Gapers delay. We all have a responsibility, and we understand that no matter how bad the history or the systems are, that even if it's not our fault, it's still our fight or our responsibility to not be anything other than the help and the hope that people need to see.
And this is an action plan, obviously, that applies everywhere, not just to places like Ferguson, Missouri.
Everywhere, every day, in the workplace here to into the public square of there.
Right. Let's take a couple of calls. We've got some people who want to get into this discussion, so let's bring them in. We'll take a call from Bill in Collinsville. Bill, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air with Reverend Johnson.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you, Reverend Johnson, for your astute inquiry as to this problem. One of the issues that I'm having is that when I started the seminary to get my master's, I was introduced to a professor who gave me an assignment. And I went ahead and did the assignment, and one part of the assignment, it continues to this day. I've been on a mission to go to 50 different churches. It was in my evangelical class. And now I have decided that part of our problem, because part of the thing is the Word of God says that if my people who are called by my name should humble themselves and turn from their wicked ways and feed my faith. Well, that lets me know that part of the problem, or the initial problem, has to be the church. These things that happen in Ferguson and around this country, it has to be a fundamental breakdown of the church. So one of the things, just making this very short, if the people are taught incorrectly, then they'll come out in the streets and then you'll see what they're taught. That's exactly what I found out. Yeah. Some of the messages, some of the pastors that are teaching these people, they are teaching these methods. They're teaching these people how to recognize what others look like and how to stay away from others and so forth. I actually listened to one pastor. I'm not giving any names of churches or anything.
Make it quick though, Bill. We're running out of time.
Okay, let me summarize this then. When people who are not familiar with the Word of God go to a church and hear someone who claims to be a man of faith say things that are bigoted, insensitive, shallow. What do you expect the people to come out and do?
Yeah. Bill, we've got the point. Let's get Reverend Willis to respond.
Well, if you've noticed, thank you for sharing, brother, and I don't discount that. There's an old computer concept. I know back when they had DOS and floppy disks, but there was an old computer concept called GIGO, which was garbage in, garbage out. And technology is usually mismanaged, and the result of its errors and malfunction are usually by human error. The reality is that even the institution of faith is mostly distorted and messed up because it's based out of human error. One of the things that we not only talk about and teach in our ministry, in our book, and in our witness is this idea of relationship over religion. And I get in trouble sometimes, Brother Marsh, because I'm a part of the United Methodist movement, and I challenge even ourselves as an insider. This is the reality, and I've said this, even in our own institution. We cannot hold critique, commentary, or raise critique, commentary, and question to the larger society and not remain answerable to those same questions, critique, and commentary. Trust me, Ferguson's still divided, but the churches in Ferguson, the churches across the country, Dr. Martin Luther King said the most divided hour in this country is at the 11 o'clock or the church time. That has not changed. Mm-hmm. That's not changed in the Baptist tradition, in the United Methodist Church. There are parts and practices in our own institutions, including the one that I represent, that are equally as damning and oppressive as anything the Trump administration or anybody other political alignments that you want to say. So we need to raise relationship over religion.
Awful lot of violence and animosity over the generations that have been inspired by the church.
Yes, sir.
You know, of all religions, by the way. Let's take another call. John joins us from Overland. John, I'll ask you please to make it a quick question or comment.
Reverend Johnson is the most eloquent speaker I've heard in years. This is excellent. I wish he had his own show on the radio too. By the way, I'm a white person, and I'm being truthful about that. I'm a white person. The problem, you hear white people say the problem with the black community. No, mostly the problem is the white people's attacks and attitude towards blacks. White people need to study, need to listen to this man. And I just want to have three little stats. It'll be quick. There's more white on white murder in this country than black on black murder, for one thing. What? Not only has attacks on Jews gone up after Trump, also hate crimes against blacks have went way up. You don't hear much about that. And then two last things. White people caused the overwhelming amount of poverty and wealth gap against blacks in this country. We cause it, not just me, not me necessarily, but white people. But I wanted to say that if you're poor, if you're a white person in poverty, we have, according to the FBI, white people in the same poverty as blacks. White people have a slightly higher criminal records of violent crimes than blacks. It's very close, but it's very similar. So I think poverty caused by mostly white people. And I'm not anti-white. I'm just saying us white people need to...
John, we've got you. Sorry to cut you off, but time's getting away. So, want to respond to that?
Well, one of the things that we try to do in the nature of this work is while we understand that race is the principal social construction that leads to injustice and equity in this country and in much of the world because of the caste system that was developed some years ago, the reality is this. We talk about community in broad sense. We talk about humanity. We try to invite people to raise both their sight line and to expand their language and their understanding to understand that these things are not specific or left to just particular groups. Everyone has privilege. I sit here with privilege as well as you. How I leverage my privilege. Paul had privilege in the Bible. How he leveraged his privilege is what is of most of greatest consequence. And so some of those, I understand the facts and the figures, but here's the deal. You're not going to convince and convict people on that. What it's going to be is how do we touch and change your heart? How do we learn how to speak in ways that are all-encompassing?
We've only got about a minute left. It seems to me that a lot of people, white people, were caught by surprise by what happened in Ferguson, but only because they hadn't been paying attention before.
Yeah. Well, and some people of color were caught by surprise, too, because they had not realized how equally blind and blinded they had become by the very systems and history and the need to kind of acculturate and assimilate at the same time.
Still a lot of work to do on this front of racial injustice and race relations, isn't there?
Yes, sir, but we're going to take our part of the mat and we're going to hold up our corner.
Well, you know, I would recommend folks reading your book, Holding Up Your Corner, talking about race in your community. A lot of good thought has gone into that, obviously, from our guest, Reverend Willis Johnson. We thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to remind folks, by the way, that you're available to talk more about this tonight at Left Bank Books in the Central West End. I know you're going to be there at 7 o'clock. You're going to have a signing and an opportunity to discuss this even further.
Yes, sir.
I'm sure you enjoy that, don't you?
Yes, I do. Love reading, love signing, and inviting other people into the work.
Okay. Once again, a reminder, 7 o'clock tonight at Left Bank Books in the Central West End. That's on Euclid, the Reverend F. Willis Johnson. The book is Holding Up Your Corner, Talking About Race in Your Community. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Bob.
Good to see you again, as always. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.